You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Joanna Trollope's meditations on the ups and downs of modern family life have earned her a place as one of Britain's most popular and prolific authors. In Second Honeymoon, she focuses on the fraught relationship between parents and their not-quite-adult children. When the youngest of their three children finally moves out of the house, Russell and Edie Boyd find themselves alone for the first time in nearly 30 years. He hopes to rekindle romance with his wife, but she's desperate to remain a mother. The book is published by Bloomsbury, and I'm very pleased it has brought Joanna Trollope back to my show. It's always a pleasure.
Well, it's a great honor to be back. Thank you.
Russell sees life after full-time parenthood as an opportunity, and Edie views it as a loss. Do you think that, is that common, do you think, men and women?
Well, it's a generalization, of course, but you have to choose something for a work of fiction. Mm-hmm. And I know there are fathers who are desperate not to let their princesses go, but there are also an enormous number of fathers who have been writing checks for as long as they can remember. And also a lot of fathers who understand that children are only lent to you. They're not your possession forever. So your job is to grow them up in order to release them into the harsh, cruel world outside.
You might just as easily have called this book Empty Nest instead of Second Honeymoon.
It had kind of less tension about it, don't you think?
The marketing departments
wouldn't have been so pleased.
Yeah, it's sexier, obviously, Second Honeymoon. Why does Russell's affection for Edie become an unwelcome obligation?
Well, it's the curious thing about love, isn't it, that all of us crave it and declare that the world turns upon it, and that in the end, that great line of Philip Larkin in the Arundel tomb, all that will survive of us is love. But to be loved in a particular way at a particular stage by somebody who you don't actually want presenting their love to you can be a burden. And Edie, who is an actress, a good actress but not a very good actress, and she has used her theatrical career, she's used motherhood as an excuse for not really engaging with the rejections of life in the theatre. And at the moment, she's in full thespian three-act drama, operatic flow about the end of motherhood. And she doesn't want Russell's love cluttering up this role for her. It's just irritating of him.
You are the mother of adult children.
I am.
How did you deal with their moving out on their own?
Well, I don't want to sound in the least self-congratulatory because I don't feel it, but I recognise that they ought to go. This was really what I'd brought them up to do. But I was amazed by the strength of my own feeling that this phase of motherhood was over.
Still, I'm assuming that that was something of an inspiration for this novel.
Well, it was actually. It was quite funny. It wasn't really their leaving home, you know, for endless college years. That seemed to happen quite gradually, and there was a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. It was when my eldest child got married, which was 11 years ago. And I do remember during the week following her wedding, which was a most joyful affair, and I was so happy to see her in the arms of this particular individual whom I loved dearly, my eldest son-in-law. I was very taken aback by the violence of my own reaction. But in the midst of it, I thought, I will write about this when I've calmed down. Well, as you see, it's only taken 10 years.
Well, you had other projects, other emotional traumas that you had to think through. Is this a way of thinking through what you're going through and what the people around you are going through?
Not really, because by the time I get to write about, by the time I am happy to write about something, I have managed to look at it quite objectively. I would never, ever use the writing of fiction as therapy.
Well, obviously, this is not autobiographical either.
No.
Rosa, the middle daughter, doesn't seem to merit the same attention from Edie that her two brothers do.
No, that's quite common.
You just told us that that wasn't the case in your life.
No, I have stepsons, not sons, but I have many, many examples among my friends, acquaintances and relations where the boys figure very largely and romantically in their mothers' lives.
Edie and Russell's oldest son Matthew and his girlfriend Ruth seem to be a thoroughly a modern and professional couple, but then their relationship falters when her salary begins to dwarf his.
Yes.
And this is something that your great whatever he was forebear with the same last name probably wouldn't have had to deal with.
No, he did not have to deal with it. And even though he was, as you know, probably better than I, how passionate he was about women and how interested in them and how he enjoyed a woman's strength of mind, he was very much a man of his time. He wouldn't have liked to see a high-earning woman. He would have been appalled to see a woman eclipse a man in terms of her earning power.
I think the first British novelist who even wrote about women working was George Gissing, and it, with The Odd Women. And that was kind of stunning at the time.
Absolutely stunning.
In Victorian England.
But you know, I think it's still stunning in its way. I mean, I hope to write about women and work a very great deal more in forthcoming novels because I think it's an unspoken, almost taboo subject. I mean, Edie, my heroine, or at least my maternal heroine, she's going back to work, which is perfectly acceptable. The world doesn't mind that. But this business of young women proving to be more competent than their male counterparts at the world of work is something society is very uneasy about. It's sort of saying, on the one hand, here's equality of opportunity, my dear. You seize it with both hands. We have put it in place for you. But don't you dare lose the warm, giving, succouring qualities that we associate with womanhood because we're not having it. We don't mind the word ambition being attached to a man, but we're very uneasy if we attach it to a woman.
And I know from my own experience, people are often surprised, even the most enlightened ones, when they discover that somebody they know is really that the house husband, that that his wife is the wage earner.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of sucking of teeth and umming and ahhing, and you know, the world's gone crazy. But when I was writing about Ruth, the girl who earned so much more than Edie's oldest son,
and whose friends tell her not to compromise her ambition to make Matthew feel better.
That's right. I found, or I was given, the most wonderful article out of the Harvard Business Review on exactly this topic.
On the other hand, go ahead, finish.
No, I was only going to say, and there was a story in it of a girl, I mean a contemporary girl, we're talking about last year, a 25 girl, who was asked by her mother-in-law not to accept promotion for the sake of the husband, the young husband.
Wow.
Horrified pause from both of us.
Yeah, well, I'm ready to retire if somebody will keep me in the style I've been accustomed to. The Rosa, we mentioned her earlier, is fresh from a failed relationship, and she's recently been fired from her job, so
yes,
she's not earning more. And you're not sure whether she's more bothered by being single or being unemployed.
She's in debt. And this is, again, a modern dilemma. Not having to save up for anything. You just put it on your credit card. And there's an enormous amount, especially I know in the UK, I don't know about here, of youthful debt. And you know how previous generations, people had lots of children in order for those children to look after them in old age. It rather seems as if the tables are turned now and parents go on and on and on looking after their children.
The kids come back. Oh.
They come back. There's a sort of infantilizing of children, which possibly isn't awfully kind to the children in the long run.
Well, Rosa, in this case, had the bad debts because she had supported her boyfriend.
Exactly.
And she has a best friend who's happily married, pregnant, gainfully employed. And we get the sense of the competitive element in relationships between women. I've always been told women are less competitive than men.
I'm not sure it's true. I think the sabotage of women among women is pretty ingenious and age old.
So we have this situation where we have a married couple who have very different ideas of what to do after their kids move out. And is that what started this novel? Is that what you first thought about?
Yes. I thought about the modern emptiness being so different from the nest that I left, well, two generations ago now. I mean, when you left home in the 60s. You left home pretty comprehensively, taking your last paperback with you, and then your parents turned your bedroom into something quite different behind your back. And now, with the young...
And then you come back and you say, what have you done to my room?
Oh, but your father wanted a dark room, darling. He's taken up photography. And now, of course, the young go out very nonchalantly, leaving their bedrooms looking as they'd looked for the last 22, 23 years, and they with a toothbrush in one hand and an iPod in the other. And then back they come. And I was very interested by this changed dynamic and the fact that when the children come back now, they don't come back as the same people that they left, even if they only left 3 weeks ago. Something has happened to them. The fairy dust of family life is not upon their wings any longer.
You told a reporter for The Guardian that you learn more about your fellow humans from fiction than from nonfiction. You mean readers learn more, or do you think that writers also learn more?
Oh, writers certainly do. I think the only area where you learn more about the human condition than from fiction is by living life. But the two go hand in hand.
But there was a time when, for most of its history, the novel was a place where we gained insights, and then there was a period of postmodern fiction where writers were very consciously not providing us with insights. But I would think that you think of yourself as a very old-fashioned writer.
Well, I would use the word traditional, but yes.
Well, you've been compared to Jane Austen, not...
Well, nobody should have done that.
Yes.
It was Faye Weldon, bless her heart, but it's a bit of lèse majesté. I know the difference between being great and being good.
Whenever people are compared to Melville or Austen or George Eliot or Henry James, we understand that there's a certain affinity. It doesn't mean they are necessarily as great.
Yes, still makes me fidget.
She didn't say greater than Jane Austen. But still, number one bestseller in the UK.
Yes, this book was.
And and your novel, Marrying the Mistress, was recently adapted for the stage?
Yes, it's still on tour in the UK in that wonderful chain of provincial theatres we still have. That was very exciting. That was much more exciting than television.
And you have another novel, I'm assuming, in the works.
It's, yes, work in progress.
Second Honeymoon is Joanna Trollope's 17th. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being with us again.
I've so enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.